The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they
engine
are
start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. It's great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. We have a great show for you tonight. We're going to do fact or fiction, but I'll tell you more about that in just a minute. We also have a very special day today, a 54th anniversary, but I'm going to let our guests tell you about that. In the meantime, I bet not one of you out there can send me an email before our guest tells you what that anniversary is and tell us what that anniversary is all about. I'll be really surprised if any of you do that. DrSpace@thespaceshow.com. On to announcements. You can call us. I'll tell you when I'm opening the toll-free line. Right now it's disconnected. But that number is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, there are no call screeners. Let it ring, and we'll bring you up on air and all of that good stuff just as quickly as possible. We have one line, and if it's busy, it means someone else is on hold or talking, so just be patient, and we'll get to you, I promise. If you want to use email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember also that we're copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download the programs. They're in the MP3 format. You can share them. The only thing we ask is that you don't do anything commercial with the programs. You don't edit them. No private YouTube channels or anything like that. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And thank you for paying attention to all of this. We appreciate it. We do podcast. We thank Andrew at gigadial.net. He sets up our podcasting client for us. You can find our podcasting RSS URL on our website, both of our newsletters, and then we're all over the net. You can find us real easily. Not only can you subscribe off of our website, but we're in iTunes, Microsoft Zune, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, etc. Also, please do go to our website. It is thespaceshow.com. So we have a comprehensive, detailed version of our newsletter there. You can't miss it. It's right on the homepage. It has all of the details of the week's programs, the guest bios. It's the only place where we have a future events section. And in addition, if we have to change the schedule or get some announcements out to you, this is where we're going to put them first. So to stay current on what we're doing for the week, please check the website newsletter. You can also subscribe to the very, very short email newsletter. It goes out early Monday morning. Send your request and your email address to me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, going back to the beginning, 2001, coming up on 11 years now. And you can get them easily off of our website. I mean, they're really easy to download. Or you can just listen off the fly and not download the shows if you want. And if you have any trouble with that, just let me know. I'll be glad to help you and walk you through the process. There's a store. You'll see it up at the top of our website. It's called Space Show Gear. Check it out, please. And then the most important thing there is support the Space Show. Remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation.org. We only exist because of your generosity and support. And if you pay U.S. taxes, please remember you do get a federal tax deduction because we are a 501c3. And if you pay California taxes, you also get a California deduction. And remember, as a way of thanking people for 2012 who do a $50 or more donation, they get a very nice custom-made Space Show lapel pin. That's about it for announcements. So I want to tell you a little bit about our guest tonight. I'm happy to welcome for the first time to the Space Show, William, and he goes by Bill, Melberg. And he's going to tell us what the anniversary is. So I'm going to leave that for him in a few minutes. He does a lot of things and has a variety of background interests, but right now he is also the co-editor of Harrison Schmidt's blog. It's called America's Uncommon Sense. That's all one word, .com. If you're not a subscriber to it, I would urge you to become a subscriber to it. After he graduated college, he had a marketing major, and he worked for the very famous Dutch aerospace manufacturer Fokker Aircraft here in the United States as a marketing and public relations rep for all of North America. He was based in D.C., but he got to travel around all of the U.S., Canada, and Mexico working with airline execs and trade press editors. And sales engineers. He left Fokker. He went to work for Ozark Airlines, and that's where he learned the operational side of the airline business. Now, I grew up in Tulsa, and Ozark came into Tulsa, and I remember going out to the Tulsa International Airport, which was hardly international at that time. In fact, I don't think it's international today either. And Ozark had a big place in the terminal, green and white logo. Nice little airline, and I remember that very well. He also worked for AAR Corp, and then he worked for Chicago-based Midway Airlines, and then he also went in to the journalism business. He was a freelance writer for many different aerospace magazines. He's had more than 200 feature articles published in magazines such as Airliners, Airways, Air Enthusiast, Air International, Air World, and Sky and Telescope, for example. He has written three successful popular books, Moon Missions, Famous Airliners, and Famous Airliners 2. I'll leave the rest of his bio for him to talk about and work through as we go through our program tonight. And it's also on the website, on the newsletter, and of course it'll be on the website when we archive this program. And, you know, so many of you out there talk about, well, space is, it really is like the early days of the aviation industry when we were barnstorming or maybe just a little bit more advanced in this. And, of course, the federal government seeded the aviation industry with the airmail contract. You make that comparison with space all the time. So our guest today is actually going to do fact or fiction about this comparison that many consistently make between the commercial space industry and the early days of our commercial aviation industry. And he's also going to address the use of taxpayer dollars in helping to create a commercial space market. So Bill Melberg, welcome to the Space Show. And what anniversary is going on today?
Well, first of all, thank you, David, for inviting me. And it's great to be with you tonight and your listeners. And the anniversary is it's the 54th anniversary of the launch of Explorer 1, our first American Earth satellite, which, of course, followed Sputnik 1 by 4 months. And I had the good fortune of befriending many years ago one of Wernher von Braun's closest colleagues and friends and biographer, Dr. Ernst Stuhlinger, who I'm sure you're familiar with, Dr. Stuhlinger. And I can remember visiting Ernst at his home in Huntsville. And first thing he wanted to show me was the view from his backyard, which he was up on halfway up on a mountain east of town called Montesano. And through a clearing in the trees, he could see that big 365-foot tall Saturn V replica at the Space and Rocket Center
in Huntsville, right?
Yes. And he said, that's my Saturn V out there. So that was a pretty neat view. But as we walked by his garage, and he had a shop in his, you know, a little machine shop in his garage, He said, this is where I built part of Explorer 1. And I said, excuse me? And he said, well, you know, we weren't supposed to be working on a satellite because the satellite program had gone to the Navy, and the Von Braun team and the Army were forbidden from doing anything with a satellite. But since we weren't too confident that they were going to succeed in launching a satellite, Von Braun put a Jupiter or a Redstone into supposedly cold storage to see how long a Redstone could be kept in storage and then brought out and flown as an experiment for the Army. But he said that was the rocket we had put aside for a satellite. And he said, I built some of the parts for the upper stages for the satellite here in my garage, since we weren't allowed to do it at the Army Ballistic Missile Agency at that time in Huntsville. And then Dr. Schulinger had the honor of actually pushing the button that night, 54 years ago, for the upper stages that put Explorer 1 into orbit. So it's quite an anniversary. It's hard to believe in 54 years how far we've come from that little, 6-inch diameter Explorer 1 to the giant International Space Station today.
Yeah, but I hear from so many people that we haven't come very far at all, especially on the human side.
Well, that's
another story, I guess,
that's another
right?
Another story. Actually, I think we have gone very far. We just haven't gone very far lately for about 40 years. And actually, that just as another little biographical note, as you know, I grew up with the space program. I'm going to be 60 years old in a week. And so I grew up with Yuri Gagarin and Alan Shepard and John Glenn, and of course we have his 50th anniversary in 3 weeks. But my father, who's now 91, in 1962, he became responsible for the design and development of the cameras that were flown aboard the Surveyor lunar landers, which, of course, preceded the Apollo astronaut to the lunar surface. And I actually, as a kid, when he drove the cameras, and he worked with Bell and Howell Corporation, which produced cameras and projectors, as you might recall.
Right.
That's film cameras and projectors, but they did a lot of military and space work. So Hughes Aircraft actually assembled the spacecraft in Los Angeles, but the cameras were built here in Chicago, where I am. And as a youngster, those cameras were packaged very carefully, and I held those crates on my lap as my dad drove out to O'Hare Airport to the air freight area and shipped those cameras out to California. So I have a definite connection to the moon from an early age. And by the way, I should add that we were invited to the Apollo 17 launch 40 years ago, my dad and I, and that was an incredible experience. Not only did we see the launch that night, which was just incredible, the sound, the sight, the feel of it, but we also saw the crew heading out to the pad. Little did I know that I would be working with Harrison Schmitt in later years.
Is that where you met him, or you met him later on?
I met him later on, but we waved at them, and they waved at us that night. And that was kind of incredible that these fellows in those spacesuits were heading to the moon. And I also had the good fortune that night of literally bumping into Wernher von Braun. I was in the visitor center before the launch and going through the bookshop and just backed into a man, and I turned around and it was von Braun.
Did you talk to him?
I did. And just briefly, but I said, Dr. von Braun, I'm sorry. And I just happened to be looking at a book about the Saturn V. And he said, oh, that's a very good book about a very good rocket. It should be quite a fireworks display tonight, don't you think? And I was pretty much tongue-tied, actually, but he was as charming as could be. And I met him later when I worked with Fokker Aircraft in Washington. And it was quite a remarkable man.
Hey, what ultimately happened with Fokker Aircraft? Where it got eaten up and merged in, or what was the final thing with it?
Well, I just chuckled there for a moment because I thought you were going to ask me about the joke about the Fockers.
No.
I'm sure you know that one.
I'm constraining myself tonight.
Well, it was always a challenge when I was with them, and I'd call and call someone, a client, and secretary would ask who's calling, and I'd say, Bill Melberg. And where are you from? I'm from Fokker. Excuse me?
Well, today, listen, it would just be part of the normal, you know, language. You could probably even text it, and they probably wouldn't even know that it's a different word.
But to answer your question, Fokker actually did very well here in North America, and American Airlines bought 75 Fokker 100 twin jets in the early 80s, which was actually the largest aircraft order the company ever had in its whole history. And Fokker was Dutch. Some people think it was German because Anthony Fokker produced airplanes for the Germans.
For the World War II, yeah.
But he was a Dutchman, and the company was based in Amsterdam. We did have a division in Bremen in Germany, and we were part of Erno, which was at that time building the space lab for the space shuttle, as well as the upper stages, I guess just the second stage or maybe second and third for the Ariane 4. In any case, Fokker had a problem, which, let's see how to explain it easily. Basically, the problem was that they were not allowed by the Dutch government to hire and fire people based on market conditions. So if they had a slowdown in their orders, and then they'd have to lay people off, well, they'd have to pay those people for, I think, 3 or 4 years, something like that. It was a situation where they wanted to keep a stable workforce.
That's something we have to look forward to over here, Bill.
Well, I won't go there, but...
yeah, I shouldn't have said that, I know.
This did come up with some of my Dutch colleagues, that very thought, because at that time, Boeing had just laid a lot of people off, and they said, well, you know, we're not going to do like you know, Seattle, last people out, please turn off the lights. But... In any event, you might remember the Fokker F-27 Friendship,
yes.
which Fairchild built here under license as the Fairchild F-27. And they had sold those airplanes all around the world, and generally two or three at a time to smaller airlines all around the world. And they also did this with their F-28 jet, so that they would get repeat orders maybe every few years for one or two airplanes, and that way they were able to keep pretty much a constant production rate of about 24 airplanes per year. But, in fact, I also remember a young fellow coming into our office in Washington who wanted to buy 24 F-28s with cargo doors. The F-28 was a small 65-seat twin jet. And he wanted 24 of those, one a month, with cargo doors. His name was Fred Smith.
Interesting name.
I think, you know, Fred had just started a year or two earlier a little patch airline called Federal Express. And he was using little Falcon jets built in France to have overnight shipment of small packages. So his business was going well, and he needed something bigger. In fact, I went down to Memphis at that time to see how his business operated, and I was mesmerized by how all these jets came in, you know, about 10 o'clock at night from across the country. They unloaded their packages, sorted them all, and put them back on the planes and shipped them all out. I thought it was quite an operation. But our management in Amsterdam, they were not too convinced that it was a very good idea. And, of course, neither, as I recall, was Fred's professor at Harvard Business School when he wrote about it as a student. But in any case, we weren't able to deliver airplanes at the rate he wanted. And we said, well, we could probably deliver one every 3 months. And he said, no, I can't wait for that. So he just went on to the Boeing 727 instead. But that was part of Fokker's problem, is that they could not adapt their production rate to meet the market demand. And consequently, some competitors came in, De Havilland Canada up in Toronto, and Embraer down in Brazil, and eventually put Fokker out of business. And that was mid-90s that they finally folded their wings after over 75 years.
Interesting.
But what was interesting is at the time that they had to shut down their production and close their doors, they did have like 100 outstanding orders. So it wasn't that they did not have business, it's just that they could not produce the airplanes quickly enough. And moreover, at the end, every airplane that was rolling off the line was being sold for less than what it cost to build. And of course, that doesn't work.
Why were they being sold for less than what it cost?
In order to try and meet the competition that they were getting from British Aerospace, which was flying a jet called the 146, and from De Havilland Canada, they were selling the airplanes at under cost in the hope of cutting the competition, but it just didn't work.
So they had a price war and they lost it.
That's right, yeah.
Listeners, I am opening the toll-free line at this point, and if I can find it there. And you're welcome to give us a call. And we're going to start talking about, is it fact or fiction to compare commercial space industry today with the early days of the commercial aviation industry? And should we be pumping a lot of taxpayer dollars into invigorating the commercial space markets, so to speak, to get it off the ground? Is it a good analogy, Bill, or do you think it's flawed, or is it so-so? What do you think?
I would say a flawed analogy, or certainly not a perfect analogy. But let's begin with a definition of commercial space that Jim Lovell, the astronaut, put together a couple of years ago, and this is how Captain Lovell defines commercial space, and I think it's great because I think he's accurate and succinct. He said, commercial space is only commercial when an entrepreneur designs, builds, human rates, and successfully demonstrates a launch system and finds a market for his or her product. Now, two examples that come to mind which fit Captain Lovell's definition are Virgin Galactic and the new Strata launch, and likewise Orbital's Pegasus match that definition. And by the way, as you, I'm sure you know, Burt Rutan has been a key player in all three of those enterprises. But some of the other enterprises that are currently being described as commercial space and subsidized with taxpayer dollars, I don't think they fit that definition because, in my opinion, commercial space, as the term applies to some of these efforts currently going on, it's simply another way of saying government contract. It's different from the standard government contract or NASA's old way of doing business, but it's still, there's really only, there's no commercial market, and we're talking human space flight here. Not commercial satellites, but apart from the International Space Station, I just don't see a viable commercial market for human spaceflight, and so that's why, in my opinion, the so-called commercial space projects are diverting both time and money from the exploration of space, which is what I think we ought to be doing. But you asked, you know, your question was about the historical comparison between commercial space and commercial aviation.
Okay, so you actually have a caller on hold already. I can't believe they're jumping in real quickly. But you know, I've done this this definition thing for a couple of years now with SpaceX and some of the other guests that have been on the show, and with procurement personnel from the U.S. government, because there's actually a commercial space definition that the U.S. government uses as sort of an official definition. So the one I hear most frequently, like from SpaceX and others, is you got to have skin in the game. And if you've got skin in the game, meaning some money in the game, some risk, it's commercial, and it doesn't matter that much about what kind of government contract you're using, or if government is the primary market. But also there's Bigelow Aerospace, which is private, and there would be a market for their space stations if they could get them up there, if they had a ride and all of that.
I think you're right about that, although I think it'd also be a great market for Bigelow's habitat modules on the moon.
Possibly. And there's also space tourism for orbital. You know, you might be able to fly around 9 or 10 times in a Dragon and get great photos
and
stuff.
We'll go into all of these things.
So you want to hear who your caller is?
Okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Richard Easton from Winnetka, Illinois.
Hey, hello there, Richard. Long time. How you been?
Good.
Happy New Year to you. How's your dad doing?
Dad's not doing the greatest. He's in an assisted living, but
I've been there, done that with my mom. I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah. But I've exchanged emails with Bill through the years. He's truly a gifted mimic. He's a legend in Chicago for his evening with the presidents. And
we haven't covered that part of my bio.
Yeah.
Well, we probably will get to it.
But I wanted to make a brief comment about Vanguard and Explorer, that my father designed the Vanguard 1, so I can kind of give the other side. But, of course, they had the Stewart Committee in 55 give Vanguard priority, and von Braun was very surprised and had a second hearing, but they gave it to Vanguard again. And in fact, the people from the Naval Research Lab were very surprised.
Richard
Bill Rosen, head of the Viking rocket program, and then the technical head of Vanguard said, they have a rocket and we don't. But, Vanguard had the problem that the best rocket engineers from Martin went to work on the Atlas. And, so they suddenly had inexperienced people, and in 56, it became clear that Vanguard was way behind schedule. And Dr. Hagen, who was the administrative head, was supposed to go down to Huntsville under an assumed name to talk with von Braun about maybe using the Vanguard satellite and the Redstone rocket. And right before he left, somebody in the media got word of it, called NRL, and the flight was off. So if the press hadn't interfered, we might have launched a satellite before the Soviets.
You had a question for Richard, right, Bill?
On the Navy getting the satellite project, wasn't that partly because the Vanguard rocket was regarded as superior to the Redstone, a superior system that they hoped to be able to use later on, which in fact the upper stages were used later on?
That was, I think, part of it. Plus, initially, the Vanguard had a better method of tracking the satellite, you know, by radio waves. Von Braun's initial method would have been optical only. And they felt like Vanguard had better scientific uses. As it turned out, when the Explorer got launched, it had a Vanguard transmitter on it. There was, I think, in the Stewart Committee some discussion about what the 56 proposed compromise. Maybe we could have the Army and the Navy work together, but they felt like that was too difficult.
Well, I mean, some people think that it was Eisenhower didn't want the Germans putting up our satellite.
Well, what I had
heard discussion
that was,
of that, I don't think there's any real evidence
no.
from that. But it certainly we did not recognize. You know, people have written that Khrushchev, the Soviets didn't recognize what a PR bonanza Sputnik would be. I mean, Korolev had big problems. The Russian generals had no interest in a satellite. They just wanted an ICBM.
Guys, the history that I keep hearing is that Eisenhower wanted this to be part of the International Geophysical Year and have nothing to do with the military. And von Braun and the Redstone were army, military, and the Vanguard, even though it had this Navy part in it, was fresh heritage, so to speak, not coming out of the military. So that's why he really wanted to push for Vanguard and force the Redstone and all of that into the background until that scene of the Vanguard that we all remember on the pad deciding to take a powder and fall over and being pressured. And then he went with Explorer 1 and the Redstone. So that's my version of the...
In with Eisenhower's concern about overflights of spy satellites. So having the Naval Research Lab do the Vanguard and as a non-military rocket, he thought would help take away some of that problem.
Well, and of course the Vanguard then later became a very successful project,
right.
But most of us still remember that rocket toppling over on TV.
Well, my brother has a story about that. After the TB-3 blew up, once it cooled down, one of the people that worked with my dad, who's still around, Marty Votaw, asked Dad, what should we do with it? And he said, well, might as well take it back. So once it cooled down, he put it in its box, carried it on board the plane back, and I was too young. I was 2 years old, but my brother remembers the next morning seeing the somewhat charred satellite.
Wow.
In our dining room.
Think what would have happened if TSA had been around back then. You think he could have gotten it on the airplane?
Well, in fact, I told that story to Dava Sobel, who wrote the bestseller Longitude, and she was laughing. We exchanged emails, but she had your very question, David. What would TSA have made of that?
I don't know. You'd probably be in Guantanamo by now.
You'd definitely get more tough scrutiny than even Rand Paul got.
Well, it is a very interesting history. And, of course, there's much more to what your father did. And I'm anxious to have you tell me your book is available so we can talk some more on the space show.
Well, we're due to get a draft by September, and I'm speaking in March. The National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, England, and the Royal Institute of Navigation are having a series of conferences leading up to the 300th anniversary of the Longitude Prize. So they're having a conference in Greenwich called After Longitude, which I'm delivering a paper. So things are proceeding, but everyone should buy Bill Melberg's books and go to his lectures because he's wonderful.
Absolutely. And for those of you out there who happen to know what GPS is or who use GPS, you should pay a lot of respect to Richard Easton and his father. Unbelievable, because that's where it came from.
One thing real quick, because it's Bill's program, but one thing I uncovered recently was Peter Gallison from Harvard University wrote a book about Einstein, and he revealed how clock synchronization was all the rage in Europe in the 19th century, and that helped lead Einstein to think about time and helped him lead him to formulate relativity theory. And relativity theory is critical to correcting the clocks on GPS satellites. And, of course, one of the less known consequences of GPS is worldwide clock synchronization. It's very important for financial transactions. And so it's interesting that clock synchronization helped lead Einstein to formulate relativity theory, which corrects GPS's clock, which helps lead to worldwide clock synchronization. So there's an interesting progress of ideas there.
And to GPS.
Yes.
It's also interesting that the time zones came out of the railway business because of the need for coordinating schedules on railroad, particularly cross country. It might have even been the Canadian Pacific Railway that first came up with standard time zones across the country, which kind of relates.
Absolutely.
And there's a plaque in Chicago, I think it's on LaSalle Street, about a meeting of railroad men to come up with time zones. And a story I heard was that one of the guys who argued against it missed his train because the train was on a different schedule. But at any rate, it's like I said, Bill is a gifted mimic and a great historian, so I encourage everyone to buy his
too
book.
Kind, and it's great to hear him tonight.
Richard, best of luck, and give, if you can, give your father greetings from the Space Show, and we'll look forward to hearing back from you when you're ready, okay?
Will do.
Thanks, you very much for giving us a call.
Bye.
You have another email. I might as well get that one out of the way, okay?
That was a nice surprise to hear from Richard.
Well, here's another surprise for you. I understand you know Craig Horton.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
All right. So good evening. Craig Horton here. I know Bill Melborg. Say hi to him. Having worked on the space shuttle for many years, listeners, you're not going to like this, but, you know, you got to let the chips fall where they may. Having worked on the space shuttle for many years, I can say that the complexity of spaceflight is not something a commercial venture that can be sustained by a corporation. Here, let me read this again. I can say that the complexity of spaceflight is not something a commercial venture that can be sustained by a corporation. I now live here in Lancaster, California, and I visit Mojave all the time. They have big plans, but are hoping for something to open up beyond the present plans of flying rich folks to space. I'll probably call a little later. So, this goes back.
First, Craig and I are on the same wavelength, but it actually, I'm glad he wrote that because it goes back to where we left off before Richard called, which is about the, and Craig is very, very familiar with the airline industry, and we were talking about the early airlines in the United States and how they got their start, and there's this misimpression that the post office got the airlines in this country started, and that they subsidized the early airlines, and that the comparison with commercial space today is perfect. This is not true at all. First of all, going back to my Fokker days, the airline business really began carrying passengers, that is, started in 1919, in Europe, with the first Fokker airliners and Junkers, with their metal planes. But we were, in the United States, we were a good decade behind Europe on commercial flights in terms of passengers. But we did get started in 1925, I think it was, with airmail. And it was the post office, the United States Post Office, began an airmail route between, I think it was Washington, Philadelphia, and New York. Actually, I think it was 1924 that they began.
1925.
25, okay.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
All right, well, they were flying old de Havilland DH-4 biplanes.
Yeah, it's the Kelly Airmail Act.
Yes, exactly. And they could go coast to coast. They finally extended the route coast to coast in about 32 hours, which was about half the time it took to send a letter or package by train. And it was a popular service. You could equate this with today's FedEx or UPS. It was the quickest way to get a package or envelope across the country. So rather than the post office hiring or buying more airplanes and hiring more pilots of their own, they decided to contract out additional routes that would connect with this one single transcontinental line. So in other words, you're feeding that line from other places north and south of it. And those were all called commercial airmail routes. And starting in 1925, the post office started to award those routes to private air carriers. So, for example, you would have Robertson Aircraft in St. Louis, Charles Lindbergh flew for them, and he'd fly the mail from St. Louis to Springfield, Illinois, to Peoria, to Chicago. Or actually, it was Maywood, which is a Chicago suburb. And this happened all across the country. So these small early airlines were totally reliant on carrying the mail. But they paid for their own airplanes. They paid for their own hangars. They paid for their own pilots. They had to operate the business just like any other business, going to investors and bankers to get the money to start the airline. And so what the government was paying for was simply for them to carry the mail, which was really a mass market, because there was a great demand and need from the public, primarily business people, for the fast shipment of mail across the country. And in other words, they weren't being subsidized, but they got the idea that they could start carrying passengers, in particular Boeing Air Transport, which was the airline subsidiary of a Boeing aircraft at the time. They started carrying two passengers in their Boeing Model 40 biplanes, which were mail planes. But they put two passengers up there with the mail, not really with the mail bags, but in a nice cabin, and then eventually four, flying from San Francisco to Chicago. And this became popular with some wealthy executives who wanted to get across the country quickly. So the Boeing then built the Model 80 Trimotor, which was, as I recall, an 18-passenger airplane, the first stewardesses. They were called stewardesses then, not flight attendants. Boeing Air Transport invented stewardesses about 1928. But you still could not make money just carrying passengers alone because of the operating cost of the aircraft. But when you added the mail to the passengers, you could at least break even or come out with a small profit. So this is where the notion that some people have that the government subsidized the early airlines comes from, is the fact that they were carrying mail to make the passenger service pay.
So what's wrong with the analogy?
What's wrong with the analogy is that commercial space, number one, there was an existing market to carry people and goods across the country by airplane. You were simply replacing trains with planes. And there was a mass market, which means that you could fly people and goods from point A to point B economically. Because you had a large market, you were carrying a lot of people, and you were using those airplanes every day, many hours a day. Productivity is an important part of and utilization. Those are important parts of making an airline work, because obviously an airplane sitting on the ground, you're not generating any income, although you do have costs while it's sitting on the ground.
Absolutely.
So you want to keep that airplane in the air, carrying people as much as possible, and with most airlines, that's 12 to 16 hours a day, and you want to fill as many of the seats as possible to keep your seat mile cost down to the point where you can have affordable tickets. Now, getting back to your question, why is it not a good comparison? It's because with commercial space, there is no, apart from the International Space Station, there is no real existing market or even a need or demand for human spaceflight. And the companies that are doing this, with the exception of Virgin Galactic, they're being subsidized by the government before they're even doing anything. They're being subsidized to develop the equipment, which was not the case with the early airlines. They were not being subsidized to build or to design and build mail planes or passenger transports. They were simply being paid to haul
the mail. You have a caller. You ready to take it?
Okay.
Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
This is Terry in Corpus Christi.
Okay, Terry, go ahead.
Bill, you got a background on von Braun. Do you happen to know if his wife and any of the old German scientists from Operation Paperclip are still alive? I know they'd be quite old.
Yes, Mrs. von Braun is still alive. She was actually considerably younger than her husband, but I believe she's in her 80s now. His daughters are alive. His son is alive. There are only a handful of the paperclip people left. I knew Conrad Dannenberg as well as Ernst Stuhlinger. They're both gone.
Yeah, but his son is over there at AIAA. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But there, in terms of the actual paperclip guys, there's just a handful of them left, which is not surprising because they're all in their late 80s or 90s now. So, but Dr. Stuhlinger was quite a gentleman.
What do you think, von Braun, if he was still alive, what do you think his opinion would be with the current state of rocket technology now? And I'll just ask another quick question so I can get off the line here. What do you think about the business plan for Stratolauncher?
Well, it's
fascinating talking to you, Bill. I'll clear the line so someone else can call. You can answer while I'm off.
Thanks, Terry.
Well, thank you, Terry. What was the previous question?
What would
von Braun
think of the current state of our rocket technology, which is about what it was when he was bending some metal?
Yeah. Well, I still have from my childhood the two books that were produced in the 50s. In fact, the first one was published in 1952, when I was born, which were based on the Collier series that von Braun and several others did in the early 50s about space. And one is Conquest of the Moon, and I forget what the other title is, but they're just it's the book version of the Collier's articles. And it is amazing what 60 years ago what von Braun put together in terms of a long-term strategic plan for space exploration and settlement. And this is what we've been missing all along for the last 50 years of the space program, is a long-term, coordinated, strategic plan where hardware development, one thing leads to another and is based on another. By the way, I'm not against commercial space at all. If commercial space entrepreneurs can make it work, I'm all for it. And I think that there would be a great need for commercial space if we were to have a lunar outpost. But von Braun's plan, of course, as you know, included an Earth-orbiting space station. It included ferry craft to go in from Earth orbit to lunar orbit, another craft for going up and down from the lunar surface to lunar orbit. Pretty much what we saw in the film 2001, A Space Odyssey. So I think von Braun would be disappointed that we haven't done more. I'm quite confident, because Ernst Stuhlinger told me that he would be greatly disappointed that we don't have a permanent base on the moon right now and that we haven't reached Mars yet. However, Stuhlinger was of the opinion that we should not even attempt to go to Mars until we have a propulsion system that could get us there without chemical rockets. And his view was we would not have humans on Mars before the middle of this century.
Well,
Stratolaunch.
Stratolaunch is the other question. What's your thought on the business plan, he said, on Stratolaunch?
Well, I think Paul Allen is a pretty sharp fellow, and I know Bert Rutan is a very sharp fellow, and what they're really doing there with Stratolaunch is it's just a launch system. I mean, the name is great. It's a launch system in the stratosphere. And the advantage there is that you don't have a weather problem that you would have at, let's say, Cape Canaveral. You can launch any time you want because you're above the weather. And you can launch from any place you want, pretty much. Although, given the aircraft that Bert designed, I guess you need a pretty big runway.
And ground facilities, I would imagine.
Yes, exactly. But I think it's a great idea. And Bert Rutan is, I put him right up there with Von Braun as one of the great visionaries.
You have an email question from Paul in San Diego. And Paul says, going back to what you were saying before you got the questions and the phone call, if in fact it's a bad analogy, right now the only way the commercial companies seem to be able or possibly willing to work on human spaceflight is that they get paid from the government, although they get paid upon completing milestones. So it's not totally as if they're being paid in advance of work.
That's
but
true.
But they are being paid to create the rockets and the systems. Do you see any other way of doing human spaceflight? Because clearly, given today, the government can't afford to build a rocket. And the only hope is that the private sector can step in and do it safely and cheaper, unless you have another idea.
Well, those two words, safely and cheaper, as an old airline guy, those words don't go together. Because there's one thing you just cannot do on the cheap, and that's safety. And the reason for that being that, here's a good example. A good friend of mine was a fellow named Jeff Erickson, who was the president of TWA at the time Flight 800 was lost off of Long Island. Jeff and I had worked together at Fokker. And Jeff had managed to get TWA, which had been a basket case, back into the black. Turning a profit again, just shortly before they lost that 747 off Long Island. And when that crash happened, there's still the conspiracy theorists have all kinds of ideas about what brought that airplane down. I happen to think the FAA's conclusion and NTSB's conclusion was accurate. But in any case, the bad publicity, night after night after night, about TWA Flight 800 crash, that destroyed TWA. That did them in. And of course, that was an accident. But if you have an accident based on trying to cut costs in maintenance, in other words, shortcuts on safety, and I hate to use this example, but I won't name the airline, but you might recall there was a terrible crash at O'Hare Airport some years back where an airplane lost an engine. I mean, it literally fell off the aircraft on takeoff. And it fell off because of a shortcut system that carrier was using in maintaining the airplane during the maintenance and overhaul process. It wasn't anything intentional. They just felt it was an easier way to remove the engine than the prescribed process.
Well, do you think shortcuts are going to be made by the commercial launch companies?
Well, there was an interesting article in the Washington Post on just Friday, marking the 45th anniversary of the Apollo 1 fire. And at the end of that article, a gentleman named Travis Thompson, who had been in the closeout crew for the space shuttle, for 70 of the space shuttle missions, and he's working with some of the commercial space people now on safety. And he expressed some concern. He said, their whole thing is cutting costs and making everything cheap. And he said, I point out that you cannot afford to cut costs where safety is involved. And he said, these young engineers tell me, oh, that all happened a zillion years ago. We know better than that. We know what we're doing. And he said, that worries me, that attitude, because, there were those who said the Titanic was unsinkable. We really know how to build ships now. So I always get a little concerned when people talk about doing things cheaply but safely.
Hey, do you think the engineers making the Chevy know how to do that so they don't catch on fire?
Well,
I mean, this stuff happens all the time.
Well, this is, Gene Cernan, I know, irritates a lot of people when he says that some of the new space people don't know what they don't know. And it's his intention is not to irritate them. He's just stating the obvious because, apart from, he knows from experience what happened with Apollo 1. He knows what happened with the two shuttle losses. But let's go back to the de Havilland Comet in 1952, the world's first jet transport to enter service. And between 1952 and 1954, about half a dozen comets were lost, the last two under almost identical circumstances after departing Rome when the airplanes blew apart in midair. And as I'm sure you know, the problem was traced to metal fatigue, a result of the pressurization and depressurization of the fuselage. Because every time, of course, you go up to high altitude, you have to pressurize it. When you come down, you depressurize it. And if you take a balloon and blow it up and let the air out and blow it up and let the air out, eventually the balloon's going to weaken and break. Or if you take a piece of metal, and this is the important thing here, aluminum, strip of aluminum, and just bend it back and forth, eventually it's going to crack and break.
Do you remember the tri-jet Boeing 727 and their safety problems?
They killed
the plane
with a super stall. And,
The sink rate. They couldn't fly it when landing it.
You're right. There were two crashes very early on because of the sink rate just before landing. So, and then you had the Lockheed Electra with the wings falling off in flight. and I should not laugh about that, but the point is that there's always the unanticipated. When you're dealing with high technology. And you can't anticipate it because you don't know what it's going to be sometimes. And the concern that I'm sure Captain Cernan was expressing before Congress when he said, these people don't know what they don't know, is what happens to a commercial company. When you had the Apollo fire, this was a government program, and the Congress said, well, we're going to keep feeding money into, for Apollo to meet the goal of landing before the decade is out. We're going to keep pumping money in despite this problem. We'll fix the problem. So that was taxpayer dollars. But what would happen if that had been a purely commercial venture? Would they have tossed in the towel right then and there? Who knows?
Who knows? But, I have a book, and a friend of mine who calls the show all the time has the same book, and we've had lots of laughs about it over the years, called The 100... The World's 100 Worst Airplanes. It's a little tiny book. Okay, so it's pretty small. And when you go through it, it's from all over the world. And I've used this book on the space show before to talk about exactly what you're talking about. These are not airplanes made by people in their garage like me. These are made by every single top aviation company in the world, airplane manufacturer in the world, with engineers, safety people, you name it. And boy, did they screw the pooch on these airplanes. with money and talent and engineers, you'd think they'd know better. And maybe by now they have a healthy respect for what they're doing. But back in their earlier days, and they were making these things, some of them, as soon as they tried to fly them, they killed the test pilot. Others couldn't get off the ground. Others were so unbelievably costly that they couldn't even fly it. It was so much money to fly. I mean, the list of what makes it one of the world's worst 100 airplanes is pretty amazing. And again, top airplane companies with engineers around the world designed these planes.
Well, so this brings me to the supersonic transport, which I think is a very good analogy.
Okay, we're at the top of the hour. You've been going nonstop for an hour. Let's take a pause and come back with the SST, okay? Does that work for you? So, listeners, we'll be back with Bill in 3 minutes. You can give us a call. We'll hold you over during the break. 1-866-687-7223. And seriously, go on to Amazon or Google the world's worst 100 airplanes. If that book is still in print, this is a lesson to be learned. I would urge you to get it and memorize it. It is an amazing story of what big companies, lots of money, and real engineers can do to really mess things up. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Tuesday evening program. Our guest, Bill Melberg, and you can call us. Our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I remember when they were voting on whether the U.S. should enter the fray and build an SST, and, man, everybody felt, of course we should build an SST. And, you know, Boeing can build the best ST in the world, and we should not give this up to others. And, of course, the program was canceled and it never got built. And what did get built was a total fiasco commercially and economically.
Concorde.
Yeah, Concorde.
Although it was an engineering wonder, and I would also say I think a work of art. It's absolutely magnificent airplane. It's just a beautiful, beautiful machine. But, yeah, the SST saga, or supersonic transport, is, I think, something which really relates to the current commercial space situation. Because I think commercial space is, and we were talking during the break there about a couple of airplanes from that list of 100 worst. And I mentioned one of the airplanes that I was involved with very closely when I worked with Fokker, which was called the VFW 614. It was built by our German sister company, VFW, which was comprised of the former Focke Wulf and Heinkel. They were based in Bremen. And the VFW 614 was noteworthy for having its engines on top of the wings. It was a 40-seat jet, a commuter jet, or first regional jet. And they sold, one, two, three, four, five. We probably sold about 10 airplanes, plus a few more to the German Air Force. And the total production run was about 16 production airplanes. In any case, the program fizzled out. And the reason it fizzled is because the airplane was about 20 years ahead of its time. The market simply hadn't developed yet for a regional jet. The commuter airlines, as they were called at the time, were still flying 15 and 19-seat airplanes, little prop planes, and just were not prepared financially or operationally to move up to a 40-seat jet. And, of course, today regional jets account for about half the takeoffs and landings at O'Hare Airport and the major airports around the world. But this plane was 20 years ahead of time. So and sometimes when you have, like, some of the planes in that list of the 100 worst, it's not necessarily a technical failure. It's that there was no market, and therefore they didn't sell, which brings us to the SST. And, of course, as you know, the entire history of transportation has been about moving people and goods faster, quicker, more efficiently. So in 1860, for example, you had the Pony Express from St. Joseph, Missouri to, or do you say Missouri?
I say Missouri. But...
Oh, okay. Well, since you said you're from Tulsa, I don't know.
Yeah, well, listen.
And it is Tulsa International, by the way, because I think they had a flight to Calgary.
Possibly that. I guess that qualifies it, right?
But in any case, the Pony Express took 10 days from St. Joseph to Sacramento. And this was an enormous savings of time. Because otherwise, if you wanted to send a letter from the East Coast to the West Coast, you had to go all around the Cape at the bottom of the world. So it took months, or at least weeks. But Pony Express was replaced after 18 months by a telegraph line going across the country, and then you had the Transcontinental Railroad, and then of course the airplane comes in. So you and then with each airplane. During the 20s and 30s and 40s and 50s, you kept getting faster airplanes, more fuel efficient. Of course, the great turbine revolution in the 50s with the birth of the jet age. We mentioned the Comet already, but the 707 and the DC-8 really introduced the jet age to the world. And so you started carrying more and more people, and you lowered the cost of carrying them because you were carrying more people on the airplane with more fuel-efficient engines, so you could bring the ticket price down. And so it was assumed in the early 60s that the next step would be to increase the speed again. And just as the first jet transports doubled the speed over the propeller airplanes that they replaced, or piston liners, so too was the supersonic transport going to double the speed in half the time to cross the Atlantic. But I really think the SST was just another Cold War thing. In our case, we had the Apollo program to beat the Soviet Union to the moon, and Europe wanted to display their technical expertise, so the French and the British decided to collaborate on building a supersonic transport, which, of course, the Russians and the Americans had to do the same. And the American one had to be bigger and better than all of them. But as we should have learned the lesson early on. Actually, I read a book recently by Brian Trubshaw, who was the British test pilot on Concorde. And he had some very interesting facts in there, one of which was that the projected sales for Concorde by 1978 was 240 airplanes. Now, and he said the estimated total production would be 1,500 Concordes. Now, this is insane. There was just absolutely no need for 1,500 Concorde, because who could afford, how could you find that many millionaires to fill them because of the cost of flying the airplane? And as one friend of mine who, have you ever heard of Ron Davies, who passed away last year?
No, I have not.
Ron was the head of the transport division at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. He was quite the aviation historian and a prolific author, and he had been a market analyst with de Havilland Aircraft in Britain, and then with Douglas Aircraft in California. And he was among the few. He was a market analyst and economic forecaster, and he was among the few who said there is no market for an SST because it costs too much to operate, the fares will be too high, we won't be able to fill the airplanes. And people did not like Ron for saying that because that went against the grain of the enthusiasts who said, hey, we're all going to be flying supersonically. And growing up during the 60s, during that whole SST development phase, I thought this was fantastic. I couldn't wait to fly on a supersonic transport myself. And you might recall the original Boeing entry, which won the government design contest, was going to be a 300-foot-long airplane with swing wings, 250 passengers, Mach 2.7.
Yeah, it's going to be much better than the Concorde,
yeah,
for sure.
And in fact, I mean, if you're looking at economics, the Boeing airplane, the seat mile costs, what it costs to actually fly the airplane with one passenger per seat, would have been better than Concorde, except you'd have to find 250 people willing to pay $5,000 for a one-way flight across the ocean. And there just aren't that many people with that kind of money. And it turns out, of course, that the savings on time wasn't that great when you work in the time zone factor and jet lag. In any case, with Concorde, which was first off the block, the original idea was to be kind of 50-50 partnership between industry and government. Well, it turned out to be almost 100% with the British and French governments paying for the development and production of the airplanes. And then they gave the airplanes virtually for free to the state-owned at that time airlines, British Airways and Air France, and guaranteed them a break-even result with the airplane. And, of course, no one else bought Concorde. And in the case of the Boeing airplane, Uncle Sam, the American taxpayers, were picking up at least 90% of the bill. Now, you know, we mentioned there earlier the definition of commercial is having some skin in the game. Well, Boeing had 10% of the skin in the game, but 90% was covered by the taxpayer. And of course, people objected to the environmental concerns with the SST, and most people think that's what killed the Boeing SST in the end was the environmental concerns, that the ozone layer was going to be destroyed and so on and so forth. Of course, the sonic boom was a definite problem. You couldn't fly the airplane over land because it was going to be breaking windows all over. But what really killed the Boeing SST was the fact that you couldn't afford to operate it. The fare structure was such that you'd have to charge above the first class fare, and there just wasn't that many people. There just wasn't a market to fill these airplanes. So when Uncle Sam, when the Senate killed the SST in 1971, Boeing could have gone ahead on their own and continued the plane. But of course they didn't, because they knew they'd lose their shirts on it. And as we know also, although Concorde performed splendidly for the better part of a quarter of a century until the tragedy in Paris, Concorde had zero impact on the growth of the global air transport network. And it, like the airship, it proved to be something of a dead end. But the point is that the federal government spent billions of dollars on SST development, and it's kind of a shame that they didn't at least finish the one prototype to at least see, you know, to learn something from the airplane, as with the B-70. But we spent billions of dollars for the development of an airplane that was only going to serve the super rich. How would that benefit the taxpayers, the majority of taxpayers who were paying for it? And this is where I think the comparison to commercial space comes into play. I've heard so many people say, oh, NASA's had a monopoly on space flight. Only the NASA elite astronauts get to go into space. Why can't average people go into space, too?
Yeah, let's open the frontier, and we'll do that with commercial companies.
Yeah, and, you know, I absolutely believe that's going to happen, and I do believe space tourism will happen, but not anytime soon. And certainly not in my lifetime. And the reason is because, as I said earlier, with some of these airplanes that the market just wasn't ready yet. That's, I think, the case now with commercial space. I just don't see, you know, I mean, Sir Richard Branson supposedly has something like, what, 400 passengers lined up for Virgin Galactic?
Yeah, that have reserved it, correct.
And those tickets are $200,000 each. So that's $80 million. And in order to carry those 400 people, you'd have to have probably, 70 to 80 flights, because, well, they're six passengers?
Seven.
Okay. So that, you know, $80 million, is that really going to cover the cost of the design, development, and operation of 70 flights? I don't think so.
Well, remember, they want to, and you have another caller on hold that we should take.
Okay.
But remember, they want to also carry suborbital scientific research
stuff. Absolutely, and I mean, that's terrific. But I'm sure Sir Richard would probably also say that, because he wanted to buy the Concorde when Air France and British Airways retired them.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I had a laugh because he said he would pay what they paid for the airplanes. He'd give the government a pound each. But, you know, he was willing to operate them at a loss because he knew the prestige that flying the Concorde would bring to his airlines, which it brought to British Airways and Air France when they operated the planes. And then, of course, that $200,000 a seat is a fraction of what it would cost to buy a seat for an orbital flight. So I just don't see that there's a market that is going to support a true airline type of operation for a very long time to come. But anyhow, we better take the call.
Hi, caller. Are you on the line still with us?
I am.
And who are you, please?
Tim from Huntsville.
Yeah, hi, Tim. I didn't recognize your voice.
I just got some quick questions to ask him. I'm going to hang up. All right. First one is, I wonder if he's heard of interorbital or quick launch. And two, I was wondering if Charles Pooley would make a call. And I'll just hang on up.
I don't know if Pooley is listening. So I just have a question for you. Are you suggesting that quick launch, well, first of all, remember, we're talking human spaceflight, so you rule out quick launch right off the bat.
Oh, well.
But interorbital wants to do people, so are you equating interorbital as a serious contender in this marketplace?
Oh, I was just asking if you heard about it.
Oh, okay.
Yes, but again, we have to look at, and going back to the airline example, look at the costs involved with running an airline, and then compare that to trying to carry humans into space. With an airline, you have to buy the airplane, which is very expensive. You have to insure the airplane. You have depreciation on the airplane. You have or leasing costs if you don't buy it outright. You have, of course, the crew. You have the fuel. Those are the direct costs. But you also have the ground personnel, the baggage handlers. You have maintenance, which is very, very costly. You have gate agents. You have ramp agents. You have ticket counter agents. You have advertising and public relations. You have accounting. A huge number of reservations, a huge number of indirect costs, which all feed into your ticket price, so that the only way you can possibly even break even, and of course, as we know, most airlines lose money, half the time, I mean, with the exception of Southwest, which is pretty good at producing consistent profits, and there's reasons for that, but most airlines, I would never recommend airline stocks, and it's because it's such a difficult challenge to make money operating these very, very expensive machines. And the only way you do it is by squeezing as many bodies into each plane as you can per flight and flying those airplanes, keeping them in the air 12 to 16 hours a day. And I don't see that happening with commercial spaceships.
You know, Warren Buffett... I forget the quote, but he has consistently said airlines, I wish I had the quote, maybe a listener will give it to me, are the worst investment. Nobody can ever make any money in buying stock and investing in an airline stock.
Well,
something on the order, maybe somebody will give me the actual quote.
Having spent some time, especially at Fokker Aircraft, analyzing, and one of my jobs was to work with our sales engineers on doing performance studies to show how our aircraft would fit into a given airline's route system. And they would give us their costs, fuel costs at different airports and personnel costs and so on. And, you know, it was always marginal. We could demonstrate that if they charged a certain fare and had a certain load factor, in other words, the load factor is how many people you have. Let's say you have 100 seats, so if you have 50 seats filled, that's a 50% load factor. And you'd have to have, 70 or 80 or even 90% load factor just to break even. So it's a tough business. Like I say, when the airplane is sitting on the ground, it makes no money at all. As soon as you push the airplane away from the gate, every empty seat is a lost opportunity for making money. Airplane seats are perishable goods. As soon as you pull away with an empty seat, it's losing money. And so you need to fill those planes, and you need to be using those planes all the time. And it's going to be a long time before we get to the point where we can do that with space. And, of course, a spacecraft is considerably more difficult to build and operate than an airplane because you're operating in such a harsh environment.
Tim, anything else from you?
Yeah, there is a couple of questions.
Well, hurry it up. I want to keep the line going for other people, too.
All right. All right. Well, I understand. I may be wrong about this, but the regulatory environment, or at least the sort of knee-jerk reaction by our politicians, is crippling towards any sort of innovation. So I'm wondering, hypothetically speaking, if the Wright brothers flew with the sort of Congress that we have today, or they would apply to try to make their first flight today, would they be allowed to?
That's a very, very good question, and that's a very good question indeed. But at that time, the first customer that the Wright brothers lined up to buy their airplane was the U.S. Army Signal Corps. So the government was very, very interested in what they were doing, but. Of course, since no one had flown, there was no FAA, there was no certification process for their airplane. But if they tried doing that today, I'm sure they'd have problems. and you're right. You know, there have been some roadblocks put in the way of commercial space. But I think the biggest roadblock is simply economic viability. And what sort of bothers me is that I would like to see the money that I view the commercial space as it's currently happening, as somewhat of a diversion of both time and money in terms of the money that NASA is investing in commercial space. I see that as a diversion from what I would like to see NASA doing, which is exploration. And although in the past week this has become an unpopular thing to say, I really believe that the next thing we need to be doing is establishing a permanent outpost on the moon, because the moon is a natural satellite, or a natural space station, I should say. It obviously it's a natural satellite, but it's a natural space station, a very stable platform for putting telescopes, for example. But also, everything that we use on board the International Space Station has to be brought up from Earth. All the food, water, oxygen, propellant, everything has to be brought up. But on the moon, a base on the moon, if we view that as a space station, it could become self-sufficient, especially if we were to put that base, as some have suggested, on the rim of Shackleton Crater at the South Pole. We would have access to water ice, so we would have water for growing plants. the lunar regolith, the lunar soil, is apparently fertile enough that you could grow plants. Quite, of course, you'd have to have a dome, but you could grow plants in the soil. You'd have water for them. You'd have oxygen for helping to living. You'd also have hydrogen, so you could be producing fuel and other resources that you can utilize on the moon to make a lunar base eventually self-sufficient, and to use the moon as a and cislunar space as a jump-off point to go beyond. And of course, as you know, I know Paul Spoutis, and I firmly embrace the plan that he and Tony Lavoie from Marshall Space Flight Center put together a year or so ago for what they call an affordable moon outpost or lunar outpost. I forget the exact title, but you know it's on Paul's website. And this, in my mind, is really what government should be doing, because it's exploring, as Lewis and Clark did. We're still in the Lewis and Clark phase of space exploration, because following Lewis and Clark, you had the U.S. Army topographical engineers going out west and surveying the west. Remember, what we now call America's breadbasket was the Great American Desert, because there was there were no cities or anything in Kansas and Oklahoma and the Dakotas and Iowa. And thanks to the Transcontinental Railroad and the other transcontinental railroads that followed, that opened all that region to development and to agriculture and to industry. And Paul's idea is to use cislunar space that way. And that's where I see, or he sees, and I agree, and same with Harrison Schmitt, that's where we see the opportunity for commercial space to really, really have an impact down the road. And that would be, serving that infrastructure.
Tim, I got to move on. Wind it up real quick. I got too many people emailing me for the phone line.
Okay, all right, I'll let y'all go.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Okay, so if you want to call,
I like that question about the Wright brothers, though.
Well, of course, if the Wright brothers were about to make the first airplane, the government wouldn't know what the hell to regulate or what to stop. So it's kind of, a ridiculous question, because the regulations today are based on 50, 60 years of knowledge and experience. And if you were about to do it for the first time ever in the history of the world, none of that experience, would exist. So they wouldn't know what to regulate. But, you know, if it was today's government, they'd learn awfully quick.
At least the Wrights wouldn't have to go through TSA at the airport right now.
You know, they'd be really big time rapid things. You got another caller. I didn't even get to give the number out. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hello, doctor.
Yes, who are you?
This is Craig Horton. How you doing?
Oh, hi, Craig. Hey, you got the number finally. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. Hey, listen, Bill, you and I have had a lot of conversations over the last few years when I was on shuttle program about commercial space. And I just wanted to say you've hit the nail on the head throughout your entire conversation tonight. What one thing that a lot of people don't really realize at this point is that our government is actually funding programs like SpaceX to a great deal of the test and development and throwing money into it, as well as Elon Musk. But it is really a quasi-governmental system that's being developed right now for commercial.
Well, don't you think the SST comparison is a good one in that respect?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, this is, space is a very unforgiving place, and it takes a tremendous amount of resources to keep up with the ever-changing things that happen in order to get to space and to develop programs and processes and safety measures to make sure it is accessible. And these are costs that just cannot be supported by any reasonable corporation. Even very large corporations like my current company, a very large aerospace company, they're just not going to commit those kind of dollars without some kind of guarantee of a future profit. I mean, they have shareholders and board of directors they have to approve. And now I'm living currently in the Edwards Air Force Base area, and I frequent Mojave quite frequently. I was there just the other day and met with people at Scale Composites, which is working closely with the new Strato launcher. And they have very big plans, very big ideas. They're doing a lot of hiring, building a new building.
A very big airplane.
Yeah, very big airplane, you're right. And but they admittedly, very quietly, but admit that down the road they are very much committed to seeing government-type programs come direction that will ultimately fund their programs. And whether it's, paid for services by the military or foreign allies, these programs all need very, very big dollars.
Let me get 3 cents in here, guys. First of all, Craig, what did you do on the space shuttle?
Well, I started out as a tile technician for the first 12 years. And then I went into logistics engineering, and then I was a production control coordinator on the avionics repair and test team at the NASA depot.
Yeah, I'm just curious, and thank you for all that great work. I wish we were still flying the shuttle.
Oh, we sure do, too.
Alan Boyle was a guest last night. He does Cosmic Log. He's a great journalist and a reporter over at MSNBC.com, not the TV station, but the website, and there's a world of difference, trust me. Alan is great, really great. But a tangent question came up with him the other day on this, last night, and he was asked about the commercial nature of CCDEV 2 and all of this, and he said, I can't quote it, but it's on the tape and it's archived and all of you can hear it. But it's something like, I'm going to defer to what Boeing says on the SST, not the SST, the 100, CST-100, and all of that. And they say, look, there may be markets here, there may not, but if we don't have the government funding, you can't possibly close the business case on any of this stuff. And I think that they know exactly what they're talking about, and I know a lot of people don't want to hear that, and the fact that it comes from Boeing, it'll be immediately discredited by a segment of the enthusiasts and the advocates. But here's what they say when they come on the show. And so you guys address this, okay, both of you. Okay, today the predominant market is the government. There's a potential market with orbital space tourism, with a Dragon vehicle, as well as a potential market with commercial space stations by Bigelow, both for getting the station up there and getting the people up to the Bigelow space station. But unless the infrastructure is created and the whole system is put in place, and they often talk about the interstate highway system that has facilitated all of our commerce and our economy as much as anything else in this country. And unless that infrastructure is somehow put into place, and only government can put that infrastructure in place, then you won't ever have markets developed. But if the government can seed the development of the commercial launch infrastructure, then you have a chance for markets to develop, because these companies can go and sell their rockets and their launches to anyone who wants to buy it and who thinks they can make money with an idea or a product or whatever it may be. Unlike before, where only NASA had the rockets, and if I had an idea to do business in space, I had no rocket that I could buy, lease, rent, or whatever.
But David, in 25 years of Concorde operating daily and operating reliably, it did not attract a market beyond millionaires, other than the occasional...
But aviation did. There are all sorts of related...
But aviation was affordable...
So I'm being the devil's...
With the SST, when Uncle Sam was pouring in billions of dollars to build a supersonic transport, who was it going to serve? Who is space tourism going to serve?
Okay, so hold on. I got an answer for you. I'm not Romney here. I can actually give you a good answer. And I'm being the devil's advocate here. So what this community will say is, everybody knows the damn launch cost is unaffordable. Everybody, except maybe Uncle Sam. Maybe they don't know it. Okay. So, but you can't get the launch cost down unless you have a different way of manufacturing the rockets, paying for them, you know, costing them out, and you have to have an increased flight rate. So with the SST example, you've got this over here on the right side, and there's nothing out there to drive the SST cost down. There's no competition. There's nobody buying the vehicles. There's nothing. On the other side, you have commercial jumbo jets flourishing from the same company, Airbus, you know, Eads Astrium, luxury planes holding 800 people, the new one, you know, sleeping beds in the planes, Japan Airlines and Singapore Airlines and stuff.
Well, the majority of the seats, though, on the A380 are tiny, squeezy, tight.
No, I'm just saying that 747s...
You're right on line here.
All of this, you know...
No problem.
The commercial markets flourished at low cost. Companies would rather buy a Gulfstream G5 or a G4 or a G6 for $100 million than have an SST or fly or do something like that. They'd rather fly their people, you know, in time saving work environment, so they can use that 6 hours across the Atlantic to be productive, to arrive rested, and that's a better investment for them than putting their people on a Concorde. So the whole world competed around the SST, and they were never able to get those costs down. So the new space crowd, this group that's pushing for this, says, wait a minute, you can't compare to SST, because what we want to do is lower this cost of access, raise the flight rate, and because the industry is in the infancy of it, we have a chance to do that with competing rockets, competing business plans, competing technologies, you know, like Dream Chaser is really different than this.
You cannot lower the cost and increase the flight rate to a point where it's going to be genuinely affordable and accessible to a large number of people.
Why not? That's my bottom line question.
I think here's the thing about the internet. Because
hold on, one at a time, please.
Craig knows what they were talking about, the early shuttle, what the launch rate was going to be, right?
Well, that's the government vehicle.
Everything was promoted as we're going to fly this like an airliner.
Yeah.
And we're going to process one every 2 weeks. Here's the real problem. Once we developed shuttle and we went through all the pains in development and testing and learned what it really took to be able to produce a vehicle that could fly like a plane and re-enter the atmosphere, everybody realized that this was not going to happen this way. And you hit on this a little bit, Doctor, regarding the technology. The technology has got to be improved so that the standards of safety for human spaceflight can be achievable by everyone. It can't be high-tech, super, you know, expensive materials and processes and techniques that only can be afforded by a government like the U.S. It has to be something that is off the shelf, something that can be built like a P-51 or an airliner today by Airbus or Boeing, that they can put together and is man-rated for space flight. And we're years away from that kind of process. And until then, until those processes are developed, the scientists come up and develop these processes, they're paid for, research and development is done, the access to space is going to be a very rich person's it's going to be his option to do, but for the average ordinary person, for the foreseeable future, it is just not going to be an affordable thing. And well, Mitt Romney hit on that the other day in one of his Florida speeches, by the way, and it was very telling when he said that he would fire his executive that came to him and asked to develop a vehicle to go into space.
But let me. So, what would you guys do? So here's the dilemma. Okay. The ability for the government to to build launches and rockets and all of this has really gotten us, you know, only so-so. They're really costly. Before Constellation was canceled, I have no doubt the technology and everything would have worked. The cost overruns were up the wazoo. The delays were there. You know, the whole, so the hope is here comes SpaceX. Here comes Orbital. Mike Griffin started COTS. Let's try to come up with a model that where we can break this damn logjam, for lack of a better word. So what would you do? Would you not even try to do it? Would you just live off of the Atlas and Delta?
Like aviation, you know, as we built, you know, got fat, Bill expressed this very eloquently earlier, as we progressed to the aviation era, we got better and better and safer and safer. But in the early years, the fatality rates were pretty awesome.
Pretty horrible, yeah.
There were, you know, headlines every other week.
And commercial aviation
really
are going
to have
this. Jet transports came along.
You know, I'm older than you, Bill. I'm 65. I'll be 66 in June. But I remember, you know, aviation in the early days. I mean, we loved going out to the Tulsa airport and seeing the planes and everything. But I have to tell you, there were crashes all the time.
Yep.
And I don't mean at Tulsa, but I mean just in general. My dad would fly DC-7s from Tulsa to New York or L.A. for business. And, you know, half the time the plane would be delayed because they'd start up the engines and they'd catch on fire.
Yeah.
And he probably had to take out insurance policy that he bought there at the airport.
In a vending machine. Absolutely right. We took out every flight. We took out insurance on a vending machine.
There was one airplane you forgot to mention, the Lockheed Electra. Remember that?
Yeah,
I did mention the wing shutter.
Dad actually witnessed one of those crashes in Boston. Oh.
There are still crashes, but they're much fewer and far between. The planes are pretty damn safe.
But David, if I can insert a question, I'd like Craig to address this.
Okay, go.
And I mean, I hate to even say this, but this goes to actually what Captain Cernan has said in his congressional testimony. What happens to Virgin Galactic, and if God forbid, a group of 6 or 7 millionaires doesn't come back alive? What does that do to the whole operation?
Well, you know, it's going to be the same response that we had after Columbia and after Challenger. There are knee-jerk reactions from politicians, from the government on down, oversight committees.
But I mean from a business point of view. Look what happened to Douglas Aircraft with the DC-10 problem.
Yeah,
okay.
Unrelated accident, but it basically did end Douglas Airplane Company.
So I've talked about this a lot on the show too, and I actually had a big rant for 20 minutes. I'm not going to repeat that rant tonight, trust me, about a week ago on this very subject when someone called in and wanted to know about accidents. And I think Virgin stands alone on this thing, and here is why. Sir Richard has a bunch of transportation companies. And he has accident response teams for Virgin Atlantic, Virgin America. The airline industry knows what to do in a horrible, horrible situation. And they have teams, and their people shut the hell up, and they don't go making stupid comments for the most part. And they know how to deal with the families. And as horrible as it is, you know, they understand what it is that they have to do, and they can mobilize. And when CNN has their mobile truck out there ready to stick a microphone in your face, someone who knows what they're doing can respond.
But how many millionaires are going to want to continue to shell out $200,000?
So the first thing is you got to have some damage control here. So I think Virgin stands alone here because Sir Richard knows what it would be like tail saying Virgin splattered all over the ground.
Right.
Okay? He's going to be ahead of the game, in my opinion, on accident response. Now, in terms of the people and what it's going to do for the business, you know what? There's a reason why these people are spaceflight participants and not passengers, because there is a legal definition for a passenger versus a participant. And some of these companies are not well-financed or are shells. And I would urge people to look into Virgin Galactic on all of this, too. I don't know their corporate structure. But you could have millionaires with a higher net worth than the company. And if they are a participant, they are involved in the experiment. And I've had a lot of space attorneys on who have talked about this issue on informed consent and what it means to be a participant. And they could find that they are more liable than the company is because they are a participant and not a passenger. They are part of all of this. And the companies are protecting themselves with, you know, liability issues, shells, this and that and the other. Not going to be so easy for the participants to shield them and protect themselves. I would refer listeners who are going to jump all over me for this to go back and listen to some of the attorneys who have been on the show specifically talking about this issue. And it's interesting, guys, that we do not yet have an informed consent agreement that any of us can review or look at that is actually going to be used by any of these companies.
One of the reasons that Concord was retired when it was, is because after the Paris crash, the load factors plummeted. And, you know, they took a year to fix some things, but, and 9/11 was a factor in there too. But the fact of the matter is, Concord was demonstrated to have an Achilles heel, and, people were reluctant to, maybe take the risk. But clearly, if you're, I mean, I know a very, very wealthy gentleman who would love to fly on Virgin Galactic, but he said, you know, I could easily afford it. But he said, could my family afford to lose me? And he said,
You bring up another interesting point, because I have interviewed the people who run these adventure travel companies. I have not interviewed Space Adventures, but I have done several of the others. And for terrestrial wild ass adventures like shark diving in a cage and stuff like that, they can't get executive permission from boards of directors and corporations for their people to even ride on the damn boat in a Coast Guard-approved boat with a Coast Guard-approved life jacket on, let alone go down in the shark tank, because of exactly what you said. It's not that easy for some of these people to agree to put themselves into harm's way for a real great, what do you call it, a D-ride, a thrill D-ride, or whatever it might be. There are plenty that will do it, at least, initially. I think in an accident, they'll be shut down, you know, for an investigation. Just they'll be grounded like an airplane. Will they be able to survive the grounding period and whatever they have to do to renovate their vehicle to be safer the next time around? Your guess is as good as mine on that. You know, they may end up out of business because of being shut down while there's an FAA investigation. And you know there's going to be an investigation.
But Craig can really, I mean, as Craig said, the shuttle was supposed to have a two-week turnaround. It was supposed to be just like, a DC-9 airliner. After the fourth mission, President Reagan greeted the crew at Edwards and said, you know, it's now operational. It was never operational. It was always experimental.
But here's the problem. If you don't do something, if you don't try to break this logjam on very high cost, you know, government-issued rockets, which are a big problem, then how do you ever get from A to B to do something different in space that ultimately maybe in 10 years or 50 years or whatever lead to affordable space and commercial opportunities? You have to start somewhere.
Well, that's true, and that's why I believe the starting point is a lunar outpost that could become self-sufficient and where people could say, you know, could see that, well, heck, we can actually live on another world, and we know how to routinely go back and forth from Earth to the Moon. So, yeah, we can go to asteroids and on to Mars. But I think, you know, this whole idea of, been there, done that with regard to the Moon, I don't even understand why people would say that. I know people would really like to go to Mars. It's obviously an intriguing world, but I think step one is to learn just how to operate living on another world, and the moon's 3 days away.
Well, you need a Congress to do. We had that as our national space policy, by the way.
Well, that's the only reason, by the way, the Constellation program never made it, because when Bush declared shuttle dead in 2004, and it was ending in 2010, the Congress failed miserably to fund the Constellation program buildup for the next 6 years after that. So NASA was constantly robbing Peter to pay Paul to get this program underway, and that is why it was running late. That is why the costs were escalating, because the cost of suppliers and, you know, specialized parts and materials that were required for this vehicle were being pushed to the right every time we turned around. So it takes a congressional commitment for decades, not for administrations. We have to have a constant flow of money and a constant oversight to make sure everything is
staying. And you both are supporting and favoring a government program, not having the commercial companies SpaceX do it?
No, I do not. I support both. I think there's a time and place for both. I think you hit the head on the nail earlier, too, as well, Doctor, as far as the infrastructure. There needs to be the interstate highway, if you will, to promote and to have basic systems that get to low Earth orbit for the commercial entities to be able to achieve on a regular basis, along with technological advancements by our today's scientists and the materials that are coming out now that can guarantee or at least make the safety equation be much, much lower, so that the average, and I say average, Joe Blow can actually go to low Earth orbit and do scientific experiments or whatever. I think NASA, or a multinational, I actually think it needs to be a multinational with allies, needs to come together in order to achieve a moon base, developing the mineral resources of helium-3, which is a tremendous resource on the moon that can produce fission resources beyond our imagination. I think it just takes a world type of a mentality and funding to do programs that go to the moon or to Mars and beyond.
This actually goes to Harrison.
Anybody thinks differently.
This goes to Harrison Schmitt's proposal last May, calling for the dismantlement of NASA and the creation of a new National Space Exploration Administration, which would focus solely on exploration and let beyond low Earth orbit, and let the commercial industry focus on low Earth orbit and also on aviation. He also suggested that we recreate the old NACA from which NASA was born, and he also cited the fact that the Army Air Corps evolved into the United States Air Force. So I think Craig is right. I mean, I am not opposed to commercial space. I think it's what we need for the future, but I'd like it to conform to Captain Lovell's definition of commercial and use those taxpayer dollars to actually do something that we all benefit from, and that's exploration and creating the paving the way and creating the infrastructure for those future developments. But one thing, going back to the railroads, and we talked with Richard Easton about the time zones, the greatest period of growth for railroads in the United States was right after the Civil War, from 1865 to 1900. And that's when they finally, all the railroads got together and agreed on a standard gauge for the tracks. Because before that, different railroads had, the tracks weren't the same distance apart from each other. So if you had a train go from New York to Philadelphia, you'd have to switch, take all the freight off of the one train and put it on another train because the tracks were different, or lift the cars off and put them on a new set of trucks on the different tracks. So when they finally got the standardized gauges and started standardizing the railway industry, that's when the railroads really took off. And that's kind of what I see missing in space this entire 50 years. Is there hasn't been a real coordinated plan that really puts together standardized equipment and hardware. We kind of started that with Apollo Soyuz years ago when we, you know, had a common docking collar. But that needs to be applied across the board, and I think some of the commercial space companies today, so-called, ought to really be thinking in terms of how does our particular launch vehicle or spacecraft fit into a bigger plan for exploration. And I mean, we hear at least one company talking that way, but some of those claims are a lot of hyperbole. You know, when you hear about sending a million settlers to Mars in the next 20 or 30 years, I mean, that's just ridiculous.
I believe Lockheed and their Orion capsule is actually trying to make that vehicle adaptable to many different flight vehicles, including the Atlas V. And
right.
So there is some commonality that is being thought into this process.
Right.
And I just think it's going to take the safety side of things in order to the improvements in safety, and the somewhat guarantee of safety for the average ordinary citizen to go fly, that's going to make commercial successful to some degree. I think we're still many, many decades away before it's going to be a $500 ticket to go up to the space station or whatever is up there.
You know, Craig, you pointed out the other big thing, though, about Congress. Right now we have two space programs. We have, at either end of Pennsylvania Avenue, we have the Congressional Space Program and the White House Space Program. We don't even have coordination there, much less, you know, internationally and industry-wise.
It takes commitment for a long time.
Yep. Yep.
And I think it takes the international development. JSF F-35 program here is a great example of what I'm talking about. As many of us know, the Defense Department is cutting back the JSF and slowing the production rate on the F-35. However, there are five or six or eight other countries, I don't know how many there are, but other countries of our allies that are also building, you know, wanting this aircraft. So the production rate in reality for Lockheed is really not changing a whole lot. And it's taken the international money for Lockheed to develop this program and to make it reasonable enough for them to make a profit and to turn out a superior aircraft. So this is a small example of international cooperation for the same kind of a vehicle. And this same kind of cooperation, I think, is needed to be developed for a space vehicle, and all these companies right up the street up here from me in Mojave, I think a lot of them are in their planning process of trying to make their vehicles cohabitable, if you will, with each other, interlinking, using common docking modules. And I think it's achievable, and I think it needs to happen, but I think the American public really needs to understand that all this money is not coming strictly from these companies. It can't. There's no way they can make that multi-billion, hundreds of billions of dollars in investment over the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. It has to come from government agencies that have that kind of money.
Guys, we're at 2 hours. Craig, do you have anything else? I'll clear it in case somebody wants to make last-minute call.
Bill, good talking to you, and thank you very much for the very informative evening.
Thank you. Listeners, we're going to wind down because we're at 2 hours, but if anyone has an 11th hour call to make, the toll-free number is 1-866.
And it is 11 p.m. here.
Yeah, 1-866-687-7223. So how would you summarize this, Bill? What's your bottom line for us?
Well, I'd like to see the term commercial space maybe just, just call it what it is. It's government contracting. Let's not pretend that it's commercial, and let's not pretend that we're going to be having $500 tickets for average people to fly into space anytime soon. But also, as I said earlier, I think that some of this focus of the current administration on commercial space and canceling Constellation had its problems, but those problems could be fixed, especially when you think about the spending that this administration has done in the last 3 years on other things. $3 billion a year extra for the NASA budget is a drop in the bucket. I mean, it's not even 0.5% or 1% of every tax dollar. But I really would like to see
I really think that, that the focus of the National Space Program should be on exploration, and both robotic and human. I think the moon is the first place, the obvious place for human, a permanent human outpost on the lunar surface, for the very reasons I cited earlier, that you can live off the land and it becomes a self-sufficient place, unlike the space station we have now. And but I also realize that we live in a time with some real financial problems in the country, and that's the beauty of the plan that Paul Spoudis and Tony Lavoie put together, is that it doesn't set a timeline. You know, when Newt Gingrich said a week ago, we'll have a lunar colony by the end of my second term. Well, you know, that's 8 years from now.
Well,
there's not going to be a lunar colony 8 years from now.
Well, that assumes he gets elected in November, because his terms could start much later.
Well,
I mean, yeah. You know, he said the end of his second term. He didn't say the starting point of his first term.
Which year he would be elected.
Oh, I'm getting too punchy here.
You know, what that plan calls for is, you know, robotic exploration early on, and I think we can do an awful lot with robotics to explore not only the moon, but obviously Mars and other places. But I really love Harrison Schmitt's plan for a National Space Exploration Administration. When he first told me about abandoning NASA, and I thought, oh, no, we can't do that. But then as I read his plan, within 10 minutes, I thought, this makes an awful lot of sense, because NASA has gotten involved in so many different things, and it's become just another government bureaucracy. And, you know, it's a jack of all trades and a master of none these days. And so Dr. Schmitt's plan is to focus on exploration with a space agency, and also to have another agency to focus on aeronautics, and other agencies to do other things. But I'm not against commercial space. And certainly Dr. Schmitt, he's on the board of directors of Orbital, definition of commercial. I think he's right on the money, and that's why I really do applaud the entrepreneurs who are putting skin in the game and trying to make those breakthroughs you're talking about.
Any idea where we'll be in 5 years with space? You want to take a guess?
Maybe exactly where we are right now.
I should have said that's not an option.
No, I think, you know, we'll hopefully be utilizing the International Space Station productively, and hopefully 5 years from now, we will have an American spacecraft from somebody able to transport our crews to and from the station.
I think we all are in that camp too, and hopefully that will happen. So what's next for you? What do you do to promote the space cause?
I continue to help Dr. Schmitt with his website, and to speak out whenever and wherever I can, and to write whatever I can, and hopefully to visit with you again.
Absolutely. But real quick, before you leave, your presidents that you do, tell the listeners what that's all. And by the way, the URL you sent me for that show did not work.
Oh, okay. Well, that's happened in some cases.
Yeah, that's common practice. But tell the listeners what that is all about.
Well, I have a rather unusual dual career in that I've spent the past 30 years traveling all across the United States and Canada as a political humorist and impressionist, impersonating the presidents and other political figures with a program called An Evening with the Presidents. I starred in two PBS specials some years back called An Evening with the Presidents. I do a weekly radio program out of Champaign, Illinois, with political humor. And would you like to hear a few voices very quickly?
Yeah, absolutely. Will we recognize them?
I think you will. I think you'll recognize Bill Clinton saying how much he
I really like space. I helped get that whole program going with the Russians for the International Space Station. And then you might recognize Al Gore. I worked very closely on that whole International Space Station.
I thought you were going to tell us how you invented the Internet.
Right after I invented global warming. and then George W. Bush, he actually said this, my parents thought I was going to become an astronaut when I was a boy in Midland, Texas, because my teachers always told them, little George takes up space in class.
Can you do President Obama?
He's been a challenge, and I figured out several years ago that he actually sounds a little bit like the late Carl Sagan, if you think about it, because he tends to draw his words and then punch them at the end, if you think about it. So, except that President Obama, Carl Sagan, used to talk about billions and billions, and in President Obama's case, it's trillions and trillions.
Do you get good reactions from the audience?
Oh, yes. And of course, I'm an equal opportunity satirist. I poke fun at both sides, and I think people appreciate that. My attitude is always to pretend that I have the people that I'm poking fun at in front of me. And in the case of President Reagan, I did perform several times at the White House in front of the president and Mrs. Reagan. And the first time I was there, he walked up to me and put his arm around me and said, "Well, if it isn't Ronald Reagan, I feel as though I've known you my whole life." And that, I was pretty nervous, but that put me at ease immediately. And he was quite a person. That was a real treat.
Can you do Sarah Palin? As good as Tina Fey does it?
No, the only female I've ever done is Julia Child, the French chef. And oh, tonight we're going to have coca bean, asparagus vinaigrette, chocolate mousse, caviar souffle, and lots of wine. Bon appetit.
Fun.
And as I said earlier, I think I might be probably the first person to do a Wernher von Braun impression for you. So. And Ernst Stuhlinger told me that I did a pretty good job at him. The second time I met him was when I was with Fokker, and it was a Washington Aero Club luncheon, and Frank Borman was the speaker. He was president of Eastern Airlines at the time.
Right.
And at the end, he was taking questions. We hear a voice from the audience, "Colonel Borman." Frank Borman, Dr. Von Braun, "Are you going to say anything about using cryogenic fuels in the airliners of the future?" And Frank said, "I hadn't planned on it, but if you'd like to come up and say a few words, I'm sure you could say something about it."
That's a novel way to end a space show program, with impersonations. Very good. Bill, we'll do this again, and this has been interesting, and I'm sure we'll get a lot of people that disagree, because everybody wants to see commercial space become successful and viable, and we want it much more like now rather than decades away.
Well, I do too, but I think a dose of reality is always a good thing to have.
always, and... I see Craig sent a URL for an evening with the presidents. I'll put that in the archives for you.
Oh, okay. And I'll send you, by the way, another link that you'll be able to hear those podcasts from the radio, so I think you'd get a kick out of it.
Okay. Thank you very much. And listeners, that's it for tonight. Thank you for staying for a longer show again. And Friday we are scheduled to have Dennis Wingo returning to the space show. Thank you all. Good night from Bill and all of you who participated. We thank you. And until Friday morning, that's it for the space show.